Welcome to the Toastmasters podcast, the official podcast of Toastmasters International. Hello, everybody. This is Greg Gazin. Albert Einstein once said, "Don't listen to the person who has the answers. Listen to the person who has the questions." Now, folks, I'm not suggesting that as host you simply listen to me, but rather I wanted to plant a seed in your mind that the idea of questions can open the doors to possibilities, exploration, and growth. But I do encourage you to listen to our guest today, who is an expert on the topic of conversations and the art of questioning. She is Dr. Allison Wood Brooks, and Dr. Brooks is the O'Brien Associate Professor of Business Administration and Hellman Faculty Fellow at the Harvard Business School. She's a behavioral scientist and a leading expert on the science of conversation. Her award-winning research has been published in top academic journals and is regularly cited in media outlets such as the New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, Harvard Business Review, and NPR. Her research was referenced in two of the top 10 most viewed TED Talks of all time and depicted in Pixar's Inside Out 2. In 2021, she was named a Best 40 Under 40 Business School Professor by Poets and Quants. She also recently published her first book, Talk, The Science of Conversation and the Art of Being Ourselves. Her article on the topic of asking more and better questions will be featured in a forthcoming issue in the Toastmaster magazine. Allison Wood Brooks, welcome to the Toastmasters podcast.
Hi, Greg. How you doing?
I am doing great. Allison, I really enjoyed your book. I found it quite refreshing. At first when I saw, okay, she's from Harvard, the subtitle is Science of Conversation, but I love that you approach the book in a non-scientific way. And you also took the art of public speaking and framed it around the topic of conversation. And of course, any book that makes references to Carrie Fisher, Princess Leia, Harrison Ford, and Star Wars, well, it's got to be good.
I'm so glad you got past the intimidating exterior of Harvard and science and got into the jokey tone of the book.
It was great. So Allison, just to kick us off, could you give us a quick snapshot as to what the book is about and who is it for?
Yeah. Well, we have to talk to people to achieve everything that we want in life. And I looked around and as a human being and as a behavioral scientist, I realized that so many of the books that have been written in the world and so many of the courses that we teach in our business schools and law schools and universities focus on difficult conversations. They focus on those obviously fraught interactions where you are disagreeing with people or you have to negotiate or you have to give hard feedback, which is so important and so obviously hard. But what I've realized is there was not as much discourse about the kinds of conversations that we all have all day long. Mm-hmm. And for me, I realized, well, I'm not having hard driving negotiations very often. And I'm really not getting in fights with people very often, but I do talk to people all day long, every day. And some of those conversations go a lot better than others. And I see conversations going a lot better for some people than for others. So let's figure out how we can help everybody do conversation better, not just the obviously difficult ones, but also the easy ones that we all have to have all day long with the people we love.
It's certainly a fascinating topic, but I'm curious your interest. Was it something perhaps you struggled with at one point in your life?
You know what? I think all people have strengths and weaknesses when it comes to conversation, and myself included. I had a unique life in the sense that I am an identical twin. I had an identical copy of myself sort of standing shoulder to shoulder next to me for my whole childhood, which is a unique experience. It's sort of like watching a version of yourself interact in the social world. I could see her having moments of success where she's making people laugh or seeming so competent or being so kind, and also see her having moments that flop like everybody else. And it's almost like I got extra feedback about conversation. And of course, she was just there all the time telling me when I did well and not well. And so I kind of became more keenly attuned to what parts of conversation maybe I have strength and the parts where I have weaknesses. As I've developed a course at Harvard called Talk and have now taught this course to thousands of MBA students and executives, What I've realized is that everybody has strengths and weaknesses. The trick is figuring out what they are, leaning into your strengths, and trying to improve on your weaknesses over time.
I love that you included the story about being a twin in the book, and you call her your real life mirror. I'm kind of wondering, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I don't know any different, right? I don't know what it's like to not have a twin, but it really, in many ways, is very lucky. You really do get extra feedback. You have a kind of built-in bestie, a built-in best friend, but it is also like a weird existence where, you know, much of my childhood and still into adulthood, we live in the same community. So to have so many of your friends have to pause and wonder who you are when they see you, is a really unique thing about being a twin.
I can imagine as you were younger, you probably did a lot of the things the same, but as you got older and you developed your own personalities, that's where you probably saw many of the differences.
We do all kinds of things to differentiate ourselves. It's funny. It's such a fascinating study in similarity and difference. You know, when we were little, we would both played in the orchestra, but she played the flute and I played the oboe. Or we both played on the basketball team, but she specialized in three-pointers and I preferred mid-range jump shots. And even now that we're adults, when I moved to the same town as her, we decided to, you know, start wearing our hair very differently from each other to help all of our neighbors and friends be able to tell us apart. And the same is true for her behavioral tendencies, right? Her personality and mine and how we've sort of specialized and differentiated ourselves over time.
Sounds like a good movie topic, but I digress for a moment there. Now the book, the title TALK, of course, is an acronym.
It is.
T is the topic, A is for asking, L is for levity, and K is for kindness. And I was just thinking if we had maybe 5 to 6 hours, we probably could cover a lot of it. But I thought I'd love to specifically focus on the asking portion. Now, of course, a little bit has to do with the fact that perhaps I'm a podcast host, and as an interviewer and a columnist, I'm always curious to find better ways of asking questions. So I'd like to focus on that particular area, if that's okay.
I will allow it. Yes. No, asking is one of my favorite parts of the book and the acronym too.
So in the context of conversation in the book, you share that there's typically four types of questions. Could you maybe briefly go through those and highlight them just a little for us?
Yeah. As a scientist, there are a million ways to slice and dice question types. You could imagine, and we all sort of intuitively know some of them. We hear about open-ended versus closed questions. We hear about follow-up questions. In my research and in the book, we focus on four very common question types. The reason we zoom in on these four types is because they are based on what has happened before them in the conversation and what comes after them. And so these questions are not just sort of sitting there statically. They're actually doing things. They're sort of directing traffic as you move through a conversation. The first type are introductory questions. They occur most commonly at the beginning of a conversation. Questions like, hi, how are you? Where are you from? How are you feeling? What's new? And then they decay quite quickly over the course of the conversation.
More for to break the ice, right?
Break the ice, exactly, in that sort of small talky zone of the conversation. And then you have topic switching questions. These are questions that help to change the topic entirely. You know when they happen because they come out of nowhere and feel like a shift. So all of a sudden I could say to you, well, Greg, what do you think about living in Canada? And all of a sudden, we're going to go off in a new pasture, a new world where we start talking about a completely new topic.
Topic switching, I find, is fascinating. It's great perhaps when maybe a topic is not interesting or maybe it's starting to dwindle. But someone might find that topic switching a little disrespectful. But in your book, you say that's not the case.
Yeah, on average, people are too hesitant to switch topics. We have, let me bring some data to this. We have a really big data set of about 40,000 conversations where at the end of like 30 minutes between people who know each other, 30-minute conversations. And at the end, you say, do you feel like you talked about the right number of topics? And about 60% of people say, yeah, I think we covered the right amount of topics. But among the people, among the 40% who say, no, I'm dissatisfied with the number of topics that we covered, 30% of them say they didn't cover enough. And only 10% say that they move too quickly across topics. If we don't cover the right number of topics, we're much more likely to sort of stagnate and stay too long on a topic rather than switching too quickly. And for whatever reason, I think we all have a lot of fears that switching topics will feel rude or abrasive or disrespectful, which holds us back from moving at a quicker clip or quicker pace across topics during our conversations. And this fear is a bit misplaced.
So it sounds like you need to be good at topic switching rather than just looking at it as a last resort.
Absolutely. Topic switching is a skill, and it's a skill that a lot of great conversationalists you'll start to notice are quite good at. It's these little moments of courage where you say, okay, I can tell that this topic is starting to run out of juice, and you can tell with very clear signs, so longer mutual pauses, you start to laugh uncomfortably. People will often start to repeat things they've already said on the topic. There are very clear signs that it's time to move somewhere else, and good conversationalists will do that assertively, and it really is a little moment of courage that can be helped with a lot of tactics, right? So like having thought ahead about what you could talk about with somebody helps in those little moments where you need courage and an idea about where you can go next.
That's fascinating. And I'm sure someone who's good at it could probably do it and you don't even realize it was happening.
Absolutely. Because that's the power of topic switching. If someone goes somewhere else and is excited about it, you just go there with them and you're excited to go there with them. And so it doesn't feel as jarring as we fear that it will.
Yeah, it sounds like it could lead to either some interesting conversation or perhaps you can go down a bunch of bunny trails and get away from where you originally were planning on going.
Exactly. Exactly.
Allison, I listened to your conversation with Alan Alda. Those of you who know Alan Alda, fame from MASH, Hawkeye Pierce, and he has a podcast called Clear and Vivid. And one of the things that I noticed is that he was interviewing you, but you turned the tables around and you started asking him questions. And I'm not sure if that's related to topic switching, but I'm curious, was that planned or was that just your nature?
It was definitely not planned. And I will tell you, having been on this book tour for talk, I've been put in the place of sort of wearing this expert hat a lot of the time. And so you show up and the norm and the expectation is that an interviewer is going to be asking me questions and I'm going to be answering. But my nature is so strongly the opposite. I'm much more comfortable when I'm asking other people questions because I'm truly so curious to learn about other people and to understand them and to figure out what they need or what they're going to find fun or helpful. Anytime I'm in these interviews, I think it happens quite commonly that I'll just out of habit kind of turn the tables around to the position that I'm more comfortable with, which is me asking questions instead of answering them.
Yeah, me too. And that leads us nicely into the next question. How's that for topic switching?
Great. So the third type of question that we use in our typology are mirror questions. This would be like me saying, Greg, how was your weekend? And then you give me an answer and you say, well, how was your weekend, right? So reciprocal question asking. These are interesting. They're very often sort of dutiful. People are asking a mirror question because they feel like they have to be polite or just to keep the conversation alive. Like they're not sure where else they should go. So they just lean on mirror questions to keep it from getting awkward. And that's okay. They're not the best, but they're okay. What we should remember is if someone asks us a mirror question, they may not be deeply curious and excited about that question, right? Like there's a good chance they're just asking it out of habit or out of politeness.
They don't really want to know what you did last weekend.
But they're like in that moment, they're most excited to just keep the conversation alive. And that goal is totally great and fine. You should just realize like, oh, they may not have a deep undying need to know about your weekend.
But I can see it being powerful in the sense that maybe someone asks you a question, you're not really sure how to answer it. So you listen to what they have to say, and then maybe that can help move the conversation forward.
Absolutely. Conversation is so profoundly co-constructed and back and forth. I think a mistake a lot of people make is that they feel nervous because talking about certain topics because they don't know a lot about those topics or they don't know what to say. But what is so beautiful about conversation is that you can always ask questions, right? Like it's actually sometimes even better when you don't have expertise or knowledge because you have more to learn about from your partner. And if you can really tap the back and forth, the interactivity of question asking and answering, that's when a conversation gets really good, is that you're quickly learning from each other. And so this fear of, I'm not sure I'm going to know what to say, or I don't have a lot of expertise or knowledge, like those fears are often very misplaced.
I'm starting to feel that if I'm in a conversation and I'm finding myself lost, if I all of a sudden keep thinking, okay, have we gone through the introductory? Have we done the mirroring? Maybe we could do topic switching. That might help me to start that conversation going.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, just what we find in our research is just having a mindset of ask more and not even diving into the types, just saying, I need to ask more questions. Number one, people can do it. It's feasible. So that's very exciting, especially among the sort of chaotic coordination game of conversation. Being able to hold that mindset and actually execute it is a big accomplishment. And having that mindset does lead people to ask good, better questions. So not just ask more, but ask better questions. In our research, we find that if you go in with this mindset of, I just need to ask more questions, it tends to lead people to ask more follow-up questions, which is the fourth question type. Follow-up questions follow up on anything that your partner has said before, and they are superheroes. They show that you were listening to your partner, that you heard them, and that you care enough to ask for more information. So they're highly responsive to your partner. What we find in our research is that asking more follow-up questions increases enjoyment of the conversation. It increases information exchange. It helps you escape from small talk quite quickly. And most importantly, it just increases likability. When people are asking you follow-up questions, you like them more. You feel like they are listening to you and care and they like what you're saying and they want to hear more of it. That's pretty magical.
I met a fellow on the plane once and he did 95% of the talking. I asked him the odd question here and there. And at the end of the conversation, he found me interesting.
Isn't that so? And you know what? The same thing happens sometimes with humor as well. When you look at the people, lots of people rate as funny. When you actually look at their behavior in conversation, often they're not actually making more jokes. They're just laughing more. And the same is true for question asking. Even though it feels like, oh, I'm not saying anything interesting, I'm just asking questions, at the end of a conversation, very often people will say, that was really an interesting conversation. And I think it's a combination of that people love talking about themselves, they like being asked questions, but also the power of questions is that it makes the conversation overall just much more interactive. There's more bubbling back and forth. You feel more connected. You're exchanging more information. And they attribute all of those positive things to you, even if you've shared very little.
I guess if you ask a follow-up question and more information is coming out, then it could actually increase the value of the original question.
For sure. I think in public discourse, there's a lot of debates about, well, here are the 10 questions you should ask at a job interview, or here are 10 questions to make small talk better or whatever. I always cringe a little bit about those recommendations because what our research suggests is like, it almost doesn't matter where you start. It matters less where you start at the beginning of each topic. What matters more is that there are many turns of the conversation that come after that original topic seed, and how those turns unfold can make a topic good. So that's sort of this distinction between, do we need to choose good topics or do we need to make any topic good? And I tend to lean in the direction of, I think we can make any topic good if you're asking good follow-up questions, if you're giving really wonderful affirmation to your partner all the way along, if you're looking for moments of levity, if you're listening to each other and showing it, if you're caring for each other. It almost doesn't matter where you start because it's going to get good.
It's interesting. I'm thinking back to an article I wrote about a decade ago, and what you're saying is, for the most part, pretty much exactly what transpired. I was interviewing this gentleman. They were developing oil rig training software, but it was based on gaming technology. And I was trying to find a way of being able to explain this, because this was for a general audience. And mm-hmm. a lot of what he was speaking on was fairly technical. So I had asked him the original question. I wasn't really getting what I was looking for, so I asked him some additional questions. And then finally, he came out and said, "My partner and I were sitting at the Tappan Gill pub having a Guinness, and we thought we're going to build a holodeck from Star Trek." And OMG, it was like, that was the light bulb moment. So it took a while to get to the point, because my original question, or first original questions, didn't bring out the essence. And so the follow-up was what actually generated the value.
It's so often the case that the follow-up is what generates the value. Because if you ask, sometimes I think it almost is better to ask the wrong question first, because it's going to be revealed in their answer that it's not quite what you're looking for. And the way people answer questions is so revealing. It's almost like you need to be, it's a treasure hunt, and you're looking for these little golden nuggets in their answer. And they're either going to give you a golden nugget and you can follow up on it, or you're going to feel like, oh, I'm not seeing a golden nugget here. Let me ask this in a different way. But either way, it's very instructive to you about where the conversation needs to go next. And unfortunately, most people stop at question number one, and they aren't really doing that treasure hunt. And they're not really looking for the golden nuggets, or keeping their finger on the sort of emotional temperature of their partner's answer. And so they fail to ask even one follow-up question, which is sort of the step that's needed to really get to the most treasure.
Wow. The irony here was that the article came out just when the new Star Trek movie was coming out. So of course his phone exploded.
That's so great. That story is nerdy on so many levels, Greg. It's so endearing.
Yeah. What you're bringing up brings me with more follow-up questions. And one of them was on wrong questions, and I'll ask you about that in a moment. But with follow-up questions, for me, for example, with the Toastmasters podcast, our raison d'etre for the podcast is to amplify the words, the pictures, the stories, the messages from the articles in the Toastmaster magazine. So, of course, my goal is to curate a series of questions to accomplish that. Mm-hmm. So what I'm wondering is, how do you balance the need for follow-up questions, or how do you balance the ability to have follow-up questions when you already seem to have a list of questions prepared? And there's only so much time.
This is such a great question. This is really the key to excellent conversation. It's the balance between preparedness ahead of time, forethought, thinking ahead about all the things that you would love to cover. And then once you're immersed in the sort of chaos, the coordination game of live conversation, finding the flexibility to let some things go, take a deeper dive on things that seem more fruitful than you could have anticipated, resequence the questions that you had brainstormed ahead of time, right? So this balance between preparedness and flexibility in the moment. And there's this great quote from the jazz saxophonist Charlie Parker, who said, you know, as a professional jazz musician, you practice, practice, practice. You prepare, prepare, prepare. But when you get up on the stage, when you get up on the bandstand, you got to let it all go and just wail. And I think that really is also true for live conversation, for synchronous dialogue, is we can all benefit from a bit more forethought, but we can also all push ourselves to be more flexible in the moment as well, and more nimble of sequencing and keeping our eyes and ears attuned to where does this conversation need to go now? Where is their promise? Where are those golden nuggets? What is my partner feeling excited about? What are they maybe seeming bored on so that we move away from it more quickly? Being nimble and perceptive in the moment is so important.
You mentioned wrong questions. I'm thinking to myself, that's probably when you open your mouth and you say something and you wish that you could rewind.
Listen, I have these moments happen too. We all have these foot and mouth moments where you wish you could go back and get a redo. Let me tell you about a couple bad question types. They're not so much bad or wrong questions as they are less than ideal patterns of questioning. And again, just like the types of questions that I described earlier, introductory questions, mirror questions, topic switching, and follow-up, bad patterns of questions are really about the patterns, right? It's like about how are we taking turns, not just about the question itself, but about, am I listening to your answer? Am I giving full attention and respect to what you're sharing with me? Am I turning it back to myself too quickly? Am I asking you a question to make you look bad? So it's a lot about the psychology of what are my intentions? What are your intentions? And are we in this together? So let me give you an example. Imagine I said to you, Greg, have you gone skiing recently? And you say, yeah, you know, I'm Canadian. I love skiing. My favorite is going skiing in the Rockies at Whistler or whatever. And I don't really respond to your answer, but instead I just say, well, let me tell you about how I took my kids skiing over spring break. We went to Beaver Creek in Colorado, and I go on and on and on about this trip that I took my kids skiing. Mm-hmm. It's fine. A good conversation often is about both people taking turns sharing with each other. What's bad about this pattern is that it follows the arc of a boomerang. It's like I've tossed out the boomerang, I've asked a question, I let you answer, but then it comes right back to me immediately before I've even acknowledged or affirmed or responded to this thing that you've shared about yourself. My research colleagues and I call this habit boomerasking.
Boomerasking.
the arc of a boomerang. It's very common. It happens because we have very egocentric tendencies. Our brains, the human mind was built to be self-centered, mostly for survival. And because we have perfect knowledge of our own perspective, of our own lived experience, of our beliefs, and we only have limited access into other people's perspectives. And so, of course, it feels like we have lots to say and lots to tell other people. The mistake is that if someone else shares almost anything with you about themselves, you have to acknowledge it. You have to show them that you heard them, that you cared about what they shared, that you're interested in it before you turn the conversation back to yourself. So we should all be avoiding boomerasking.
So Allison, on the topic of wrong questions, have you ever asked a wrong question or have been asked a wrong question? And how did you find your way out of it?
Oh, what? Of course. Well, even the phrase wrong question has this sort of presumption that there are right questions and wrong questions, or good questions and bad ones. So much of what makes questions good or bad lives in the mind of the people who are talking to each other, right? Like questions that they're excited to answer or not excited to answer, questions that have an assumption built into them that are flattering or an assumption built into them that are hurtful, right? So there's all kinds of things that can go right and wrong with question asking. I have 3 kids, which means I've experienced the game of being pregnant 3 times. That's with 3 kids, it's a lot of months of pregnancy to watch other people sort of dance around this "are you pregnant" question. And I think early on in a pregnancy, people are nervous to ask, "Are you pregnant?" As you get bigger and bigger and towards the end of your pregnancy, they feel nervous to not ask, like it's awkward if they don't talk about it. And so within a 9-month time horizon, you can see people's fears morph over time. There's really nice research that shows that on average, we are too afraid of asking sensitive questions, that on average, if you ask people to actually ask the questions that feel too sensitive to ask, it doesn't make the conversation worse and often makes the conversation much better, including the sort of, are you pregnant, right? So asking sensitive questions itself suggests that someone feels close enough to you or trusting enough that they feel confident to ask you those questions. Of course, there are all kinds of caveats and exceptions to this. One phrase that has stuck with me and that I think is true is that there is no such thing as a sensitive question, but there are such a thing as sensitive contexts. In private, between close friends, you would hope that you could say, I'm so excited to ask you, are you pregnant? But if you were to ask that same question in front of a room full of strangers very early on or with a couple that's been struggling with fertility, all of a sudden, that's not an okay question to ask. And so again, it's just a phrase that I find very helpful. There's no such thing as a sensitive question. There's only sensitive contexts. And so we, as good conversationalists, it's our job to read the room, read ourselves, read our partners, and figure out what's an appropriate question to ask in each context.
If you've enjoyed this episode and all the questions, and even better, all of the answers, please stay tuned for part two coming up in our next episode. In part two, Harvard professor and author Allison Wood Brooks returns as we continue our deep dive into the power of asking better questions, drawing from her opening story in the questions chapter of her book, Talk, The Science of Conversation and the Art of Being Ourselves. We'll explore how NPR's Terry Gross and the late Carrie Fisher, best known as Star Wars Princess Leia, built a relationship over three decades of interviews with questions that evolved alongside their connection. Allison also shares tips on reframing sensitive topics, using AI for prep, and creating more emotionally engaging conversations for podcasts, table topics, and everyday life. If you can't wait for the next episode and you want to find out more about Allison, you can reach her at allisonwoodbrooks.com, and that's Allison, A-L-I-S-O-N, Allison with one L. Stay tuned for part two.